Well, good evening and welcome to this extra special edition of DFA Live. And I have with me the world's greatest property insider, Edwin Almeida. Well, I think it's Edwin. Hi, Edwin.
G'day, Martin. Yeah, look, world's greatest insider, but I'm going to try setting up my own political party. I don't know who to affiliate myself with at the moment, whether it's going to be China or the United States. So I figured I'd combine the two and come up with my own hat and everything. So hope it works.
Oh, it looks pretty interesting. Yeah. I mean, you could set your own country up, you know, and set your own rules as well.
The state governments don't want to open up the border, so I get that theoretically that are they trying to secede from the Commonwealth? Is that what they're trying to do?
Yeah, very good. So just to explain a few things, guys, we're not going to run a lot of pre-show and intro and what have you today. We're going to go straight into the questions because we have so many questions already. And I've got Edwin here with down the Skype, so hence the audio and everything. But I think you can hopefully hear him okay. He's looking as though he's registering the right amount of gain. So any issues on the audio, let me know. Voice is not good, Edwin, he says. Okay, well... Edwin comes up with all those little stunts. Okay, so what I want to do is just really go into the questions, Edwin. But before we go to that, let me just give you a chance just to give people a little bit of a... Because you've got a very particular take on property and those things, but it's from your experience. So just give people a bit of a sense of that.
With the history that I've got in the industry and I guess the information that I've gathered over the last... 2.5 decades, it's been invaluable to look at the actual trends and what's happening, particularly in the Sydney market. I had ventured to Queensland from time to time and haven't really done much work in Victoria, but it's interesting how people gravitate towards certain properties, certain investments. I've seen the changes that government policies have made and the changes that have brought about, the high-rise construction, the lax changes to regulations and legislation, which has enabled overseas investment to come in the droves, plane loads, boat loads, truck loads, and send properties sky high. But unfortunately, I've also been able to being a witness to the fact that with the higher that we've been building, unfortunately, the standards haven't kept up with the amount of property being built and the buildings with the height and the mass. So on the one hand we've built a lot, but a lot of what is the big question which is coming to bear now. So I've seen a lot on the ground. I talked to a lot of agencies involved with different industry bodies. So I've been able to gather a lot of information. So it's I guess. I'm on the ground sniffing out what's actually happening as opposed to what the mainstream media are telling people that are happening and as opposed to the spruikers that are telling the general public as to what's happening.
Yeah, no, it's very important. And just to explain, we had a slight technical hitch here before this started, so I'm not on my main system tonight. I've got a slightly kludged system, and part of that kludge is that Edwin's on an iPad. I'm feeding his video directly in to the switcher, but his audio is coming through a slightly convoluted route, hence the slightly tinny sound, but hopefully you can still hear what he says. That's the main thing. I think most people are saying they can, but it's not totally clear to listen to. So I'm sorry about that. That's the best we can do, I think, given the slight problem, the slight problems, given the problems we had earlier on. On that basis, Edwin, can we just have a look at some of the questions that people have been asking? And I'm going to start with one from Bill. Right, Bill said, I live in a high-rise built about 3 years ago. There's a number of cracks appearing in the cladding and in the car park. I've approached the Strata Management Committee, but they're denying anything is wrong. The development company has disappeared. What do you think my best approach is, given that if I make too much fuss, the value of my place might fall?
Well, Bill's one of hundreds of thousands of owners in the same situation. And unfortunately, that is the cloak that a lot of these strata companies, builders and developers are hiding under, which is unfortunate. Look, unless you go public and unless you go hard, I know a lot of owners corporations seem to want to chase the developer and the builder, but most of those shelf companies have already been deregistered or have been closed down, so they've got really no. There's nothing to chase in a $2 company, as they say. With regard to private certifiers, well, again, who do you chase when a lot of these private certifiers have gone bust? I think a lot of attention needs to be placed on the strata company, the strata managers themselves that got originally appointed by the owners, by the developers at the initial stages, and they didn't fulfill with their obligations or their regulatory obligations to produce documentation, to produce reports to build the building company and the developers in order to get the rectification work done within a statutory period. And that is what a lot of developers and builders have also taken advantage of, because they feed these strata companies the work, and therefore the strata companies don't really want to go back and make claims, because they don't want to, you know, they don't want to bite the hand that feeds them.
Well, that's interesting. Now, Peter said, hunt down the engineer. He's the only one with real responsibility and insurance. What do you think about that?
Yeah, look, the idea is to hunt down the people, as Peter says, to hunt down, I like that word, hunt down the people that that do have the professional indemnity insurance. But I say, I think that you stand a lot better chance chasing the strata companies that originally got appointed by the builder and the developer, and they didn't put in place the regulatory reports in order to also have something to stand, a leg to stand on when you do chase the engineer, when you do chase anybody that has professional indemnity insurance. Because if the work hasn't been done, they could just literally throw their hands up in the air and say, oh well, look, we were there, we were ready. But unfortunately, the statutory time that was required for the strata company to do something, they've it's gone past its use by date, so we're scot free. A lot more onus needs to be placed, and a lot more pressure needs to be placed on those strata management companies.
Okay, very interesting. Now, Vincent Choi has asked, I've been contacted by multiple REAs with new properties with motivated sellers. Edwin, what are you seeing on the ground? On your side,
I think a lot of the people there are a lot of people attending open floor inspections. I get the feeling a lot of the people that were a bit wanting to see what not necessarily are on the market to buy. I've heard reports from actual vendors telling me that they've had numerous amount of people going through the open homes. But as the agents called them back, there's nobody there to really, the so-called buyers aren't calling back or aren't making offers. There's a bit of interest. I think it's a bit of a sticky beak. I think people are preparing. Having a look at what's on the market, so that perhaps when they come on the market themselves, they can see what their competition is going to be like. In terms of motivated, the agents use the term motivated vendors, but on the other hand, they'll also tell the vendors in order to list the properties that they've got keen buyers. So you really got to take what agents tell you, with a grain of salt.
Right, and agents, of course, just to remind everybody, agents are there to do a deal, right? They only win if they can find a way to do a deal. So in a way, you've all got to ask an interesting question as to, well, who are they actually working for? They're actually working to get a deal.
Yeah, look, their obligation is to get the best result for the vendor. But second to that, and very close, if not on par with that, is the working for themselves. Let's make no qualms about it. I'm in the industry, and let's just call it the way it is. If you don't get the sale, you don't get the commission. If the property goes, is not sold in the period of time that the vendor has given you the property, to sell, well, then it goes on to the next agent, and the next agent is more than likely going to get the commission. So basically, you do want to achieve the best price for your vendor, and as much as we complain, or people complain as to the strategies that agents use, look, every industry has its flaws, every industry has its knockbacks, every industry has its question marks attached to it, and unfortunately, my industry is picked on a lot because of the nature of the game, and a lot of people get offended by a lot of real estate agents, be it from all sides, property management, and selling agents. But I think what pisses a lot of people off, Martin, and this is what also pisses me off, and I'm in the industry, is when agents don't disclose the sales price. And I think that's really one of the biggest bugbears that people have. When agents don't disclose the sold prices, and then that fuels that hatred towards the industry. So, look, at the end of the day, you just got to take it as it comes, and you just got to make a judgment yourself. Sooner than later, you're going to find out what properties are being sold for, and sooner or later, if you put your property on the market, you're going to see whether or not there are real buyers out there and they're willing to pay the price that you want to sell your property for.
Yeah, there is a acid test, isn't it? Did it sell or did it not sell? Eric said, regarding real estate agents, no man can serve two masters. So that's an interesting perspective in terms of that. And I got an interesting one up here from another Martin, actually. Martin Edwin, would you rather buy property in Australia or New Zealand? What are the key markers that differentiate those two markets? Don't know whether you know much about New Zealand, but be interesting to get your perspective, and I'll share a little bit of my perspective.
Look, I have a lot of friends that have bought property in New Zealand. I don't follow it as much as what I used to over a decade ago, but I don't think it's that easy to buy property in New Zealand as far as I'm aware. I mean, you could you're a lot closer to that because of the people that come on your show from New Zealand to talk about it. I've got a lot of friends that have bought property in America as well. I've got a lot of friends that bought property in New Zealand, as I said. But I like to be a lot closer to the game in order to. I personally don't have any interest in buying property in America or buying property in New Zealand because although I've got family in those parts, I don't. I'm just a little bit. I think a little bit different. So I'm not much. I don't have a lot to say on that New Zealand front, man.
Okay, fair enough. Well, I can tell you a few things. So we know that some of the debt ratios in New Zealand are actually more extreme than here. The loan-to-value ratios more recently have been more extreme. And we know that there's been a lot of initiatives to try and bring first-time buyers forward in New Zealand. That means, of course, with what the Reserve Bank over there has been doing, there's been quite a lot of attempt to essentially use the housing market to drive the economy. Now, the same true is in Australia, but the Australian context has dialed back a little bit until quite recently, taking off now. So my own perspective is I think probably the New Zealand end of things is probably even more exposed to risk. I think that the expectations in terms of future home prices over there are still quite positive, although all of the leading indicators that we're seeing in Australia, we're also seeing in New Zealand as well. And in fact, I'm recording a show with Joe Wilkes in a couple of days' time, where we're going to try and go into a bit more detail as to what we think is going to happen in the New Zealand property sector because of COVID, because of the things that are going on there. I think the other point to make is it's not so much the country, but it's the location and the particular property and the particular top property type that you buy. Because, in both places, there are good properties and there are bad properties. One of the things I keep coming back to is a dog of a property is a dog of a property, whether you buy it in New Zealand or in Australia. So in a way, it's quite important to try and, pick out the quality property rather than just think of Australia or New Zealand as being effectively a better place. I think both are subject to two things. One is way too much debt, and therefore house prices driven way higher than they should have. And secondly, tremendous risk at the moment of price correction. And, you know, my own modelling, as I presented over the weekend, my own modelling is that price is likely to fall rather than rise from this point.
Can I also say, Martin, of late, there've been a lot of natural disasters in New Zealand than what I used to hear of as well. So that's another reason why I wouldn't perhaps go there.
Yeah, earthquakes. Good point. Yes, I've forgotten the earthquakes. Yeah. No, you're right. Okay. Now, there's a question here from the stranger. Wondering what your thoughts are for regional property, given that the current state is that people will start working from home, so perhaps buying in capital cities is less required. In other words, are we going to see a bit of a spread out because of the, working from home and all those things? And of course, regional properties are a lot cheaper than those in close to the CBDs. What's your thoughts there, Edwin?
Well, I think we mentioned it about maybe 4 or 6 weeks ago, Martin, when I said that a lot of people are going to there's going to be a shift to the regional further out afield from the CBDs. The appetite to live in high rise is going to change. COVID-19 is not the only virus that people are going to be conscious of. I think if anybody coughs on a train, if anybody coughs in a lift, people are going to want to take 2-3 steps backwards away from the person that just coughed or sneezed or is blowing their nose. We're going to be more conscious of this. This lifestyle that's been created, and for many years I've been saying that we've been building $1 million ghettos around Sydney as it is, because it's a combination of viruses, a combination of the fact that strata managers aren't doing the jobs properly, they're not maintaining the buildings, owners corporation are running at a loss, so therefore they don't maintain the buildings properly, so we've amassed $1 million ghettos all around Sydney. So I think with this change, COVID-19 that's hit us, I think people are going to start travelling further afield, which is something that I mentioned in one of our previous shows, Martin, because of the simple fact that they've now realised, hey, I can be just as productive working from home and working away from the CBDs, and I don't have to go into the CBDs as often as I would have otherwise wanted to. And quite frankly, I bought myself a coffee machine, and now I can have coffees at home, and enjoy a coffee at home, and I don't have to go to the coffee shops, because that's, there's all sorts of reasons. Lifestyle. How many people in lockdown that were caught in the high-rise developments or in the denser areas were wishing that they lived on the old quarter-acre blocks? Me personally, I don't I don't like mowing lawns. But then again, when you're locked down in a three-bedroom apartment or a three-bedroom townhouse with not much room, and you've got a family of four or five, you can't escape. You pull your hair out. So these are the thoughts that are going to be going through people's minds. So regional, I think, is the go. I think Goulburn is picking up, and it has picked up a lot in terms of growth, momentum, and people wanting to gravitate outside of Sydney. And it's not that far away from Sydney when you think about it.
Yeah, good point. And of course, I moved down from Sydney nearly a decade ago now to close to Wollongong, and was able to find somewhere quite a lot cheaper with that better lifestyle, beach and escarpments and all those things, and still get access to the city if I need it on the train, although I don't want to go near the train at the moment with COVID. I think I'll avoid that. But what's interesting is that if you look at it from another perspective, and that is the economics of buying in regional areas, the problem also is that many people in the regions are also on lower incomes too. So in fact, mortgage stress is not something that's just concentrated in the major urban areas. We are seeing swathes of mortgage stress in many different parts of the country, including many regional areas. And what I wonder will happen is, if you've got people with bigger incomes who are now working from home and they can buy further out, we could well see that they are actually going to be able to replace and if you like, buy the properties that some of the locals can't afford to buy. So there are some interesting social questions here with regards to how this may play out. And I'm not altogether sure that, you know, spreading the load, if you like, and trying to get prices to go higher into regional areas is necessarily a very smart move, because it's going to make housing affordability in those areas worse. And, you know, across the country, housing affordability is a big deal. So if you look at the information, they actually showed that there were actually regional centres in Australia that are also struggling with affordability. So I guess my own view is it would be rather nice if we could find a way to, you know, keep prices down rather than actually lift regional prices higher. Edwin, I want to read you this one too. This is one that came in before, from Jordan. He said, "My girlfriend and I are first-time buyers in Sydney, looking to move into a place of our own. We would be owner-occupying for at least 5 to 10 years. What advice would you offer us in the current circumstances?"
Stay with your parents. It's cheaper.
Okay. Short and cheap. Is there any reason to buy at the moment, do you think?
I think, look, personally, and again, this is my own personal opinion, I think you waited out this long, waited out a little bit longer, and let's see what happens with the with the JobKeeper allowances and the job seeker and the job creeper and everything else that the government's thrown at this, because once all those grants and subsidies and whatever else end, we're really going to see what the volumes of properties that are going to drop on the market. One. Secondly, we're moving into winter, which is generally, and again, I'm talking Sydney specific. We're moving into winter, which is generally not a good time for people to list their properties anyway. Traditionally, and people are going to wait until spring before they start listing their properties for sale. However, what I've noticed is that the 17,500 properties that have been listed on Domain have stayed consistent. So, if anything, it should have dropped down to at least 15,500 properties for sale across Sydney, but they haven't. This week, at the beginning of the week, it picked up quite a bit of pace. It's going to be interesting to see what people are doing. So this whole people are weighing up whether or not they put the properties on the market. But I just wait a little bit longer. Wait until these grants and these subsidies and whatever else fall by the wayside, and we'll see what this pandemic has really left in its wake. And I get the feel that we could end up with anywhere between 24 and 25,000 properties listed for sale throughout spring, which brings us back to the normal numbers from a couple of years ago. But on the other side of the equation, it will be the normal numbers of listings. But in terms of buyers, I don't think there's that many buyers. There are that many buyers out there.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I mean, I've always said, if you are somebody looking to buy a property to live in for the long term, right, not as an investment, but as somewhere to live, and the main reason for buying is effectively security and knowing it's your own, and you're prepared to take the risk of values dropping further from where they are, so you might lose some of the equity that you've put into the property early days. For example, some of the 95% first-time buyers, 10,000 is now just reached, I saw today. A lot of those are actually losing money, right? So if you're prepared to do that and prepared to sit through the dip but there is a significant risk of doing it now, because the chances are prices will fall further. And as Edwin has said, there's more properties being listed and more will be listed ahead. And somebody asked about the situation. Thank you very much for El Pornu. Appreciate that. Thanks for your support. The point there is that JobKeeper and JobSeeker won't go on forever, right? And whether it's going to be tapered or whether it's going to be dropping in September, I don't think they can kill it off. I think they'll have to sort of taper it out. But what this tells me is that this is not something that is going to get cured in 3 months or 6 months, right? We're going to have a significant economic downturn for at least another 18 months. Even the Reserve Bank says that. So there's no hurry to buy, in my view. And, you know, as you wait, you'll probably see more properties coming on the market. You'll have more choice. You may be able to buy closer in from where you might be able to buy today. So I would say just, you know, hang loose. Just, you know, just go with it carefully. Don't rush. I don't think there's a need to rush. And of course, all the estate agents out there are trying to say, buy, buy, buy. You know, first time buyers, great time to buy. Well, yeah, it might be 10% down from where it was 3 or 6 months ago. But if it's going to drop another 20% in the next year, you want to be much more careful.
Or if you really want to go out into the market, Martin, what I suggest and I recommend they do is go look around and give the agent an offer, you know, 15-20% below what they're asking on the day, and that way they mitigate their loss. If the market drops 30%, well, you know, they've got it 20% cheaper than what it is at the moment. And you know what I mean? So if they really find something that they fall in love with, and they're going to be there for a very long time, and that's what I tell family and friends, and that's what I tell my clients as well. Yeah, when we go in there, knowing that if the market's going to drop, a bit more, we try to mitigate that drop by lowballing the offer. I don't think, and I think more, I personally think, feel, and I can see that more property is coming on the market, and just wait. I don't think there's any people are fearful of of overseas investors. I can tell. You can get knocked down on the head real quick because they're not there. The overseas investors aren't there. They've got the Chinese government are not allowing them to won't allow them to take the money out of China. They can leave China, but they've got to leave the money behind. So the economic situation there isn't as rosy as what the mainstream media may make it out to be. You know, here to say, you know, to spruik Australian real estate for, you know, Chinese appetite. It's not there. They're thinking more of staying alive there than what we are. Yeah, feeding the families on a weekly basis, let alone buying bloody investment properties in Australia.
Yeah, and there was a question, actually, one of the ones that sent beforehand about China. I think you touched on it. I'm very sceptical of this sudden surge of people coming from China to buy up all the property, or Hong Kong, you know, as though suddenly it's all going to sort of go the other way. And by the way, you know, they have other markets also that they could also look at. But you're right, the critical thing issue is Edwin, is that getting money out now is way more difficult than it was. And I know that there have been a number of Australian companies essentially flogging into China. So in other words, building here but trying to sell into China. And they're having a terrible time at the moment, aren't they?
Bad time. They're not even the young people here are at war with each other because they know on the one hand, you know, one group tells, you know, selling investors don't buy, and on the other hand, you know, people can spruik as much as they want. We got the REA saying, oh yeah, there's been searches online. I mean, people are searching and looking because they've got nothing better to do when they're on lockdown, or because, yeah, even over there, they're sitting at home trying to figure out whether or not, perhaps they're trying to figure out whether or not the investment that they bought 5 years ago for $1 million is still worth $1 million, or is it dropped down to 650? And the other thing that people have got to understand is that overseas investors, no matter where they come from, they can only buy new. Yeah, they can set up special purpose vehicles in order to skate around the foreign investment review regulations. Yeah, they can set up companies, they can set up trusts under the companies, they can do all that. But in order to do that, they've got to have greater deposits for the local banks to loan the newly set up companies or the newly set up trusts underneath companies. So yeah, it's not as easy as what a lot of people tend to think. And let's face it, there's still a lot of the countries overseas are in the proverbial poop hole, more so than us. Yeah, at least we've had some sort of management and control over the COVID-19, and we flattened the curve. But a lot of these other countries, they're still fighting with it. And I don't think there's any appetite any appetite whatsoever for people to come over and buy at the moment. And I can't see that happening for the next, you know, best case scenario, at least 12 months. That would be best case scenario in my view of any significance for people wanting to come over. There's so much that they've got to do when they come over. Imagine airplane tickets at the moment, I think from certain parts of Asia to Australia are $5,000 one way. So you got to, you know, it's $10,000 two ways. When they get over here, they got to pay for their own quarantine. When they fly back, then they've got to be quarantined again. I mean, that expense alone is probably around $20,000-$25,000. I don't think there's a real appetite there. There may be a wish, but I don't think they can for political reasons. And other reasons and economic reasons, because they've got to save their principal places of residence in their own countries, and the economy over there is in a bigger mess than what we know it is.
Yeah, very true. And they've announced in China some further stimulus today to try and actually give the economy a bit of a kick forward. But of course, they're actually not projecting now a GDP number for next year. So now I've got an interesting question here from Dino. What are your thoughts on the possible 40K cash injection on property prices? So now the 40K is from the master builders, right? And a couple of the other organisations in the building sector said, no, it should be 50K. So the idea is you throw that money at first-time buyers to try and encourage them to buy new property to try and kickstart the construction sector. Is it 40K? Is it 50K? Does it make any sense, Edwin?
It doesn't make a difference. I can tell you now because it hasn't worked in the past. Yeah, for the last two decades, with the different grants that have been thrown around for first-time buyers, particularly, first of all, it's going to be grants given to people to buy new. Again, we're talking about new. Why would you want to buy a $750,000 four-bedroom house on 380 square meters at a bloody Jordan Springs or at a Woopwook, Schofields or something like that? And when you could buy something that's what we call secondhand or established property just around the corner from something that's being built new, on a bigger block of land for $100,000 less, or because you're not going to get the $40,000. I mean, it's not rocket science. Who takes that money? That money is going to be taken up by the developer, by the builder, and by the real estate agents. They're the ones that are going to benefit from it, not you as a first-time buyer as an incentive. And frankly, there's going to be so much choice closer to the city of more established properties in established areas and suburbs that have got infrastructure, as opposed to going the middle of nowhere, at a whoop with no real infrastructure, where you have to commute a lot further to go to work. If you do have to commute to go to work or to go to anything of relevance, I don't. It's just. I think there's going to be too many, the volume of secondary property that's going to be on the market is going to make that insignificant as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and of course the banks may well later start foreclosing on people, not immediately, but probably later. So that will be another force that will actually potentially apply more downward pressure too. Now, there was an interesting question from Jerome. I was wondering, he says, on your thoughts on all the retail developments with apartments above them. Seem to be thousands and thousands of vacant properties, retail properties, as well as the ones above. What's this going to do to the market? And, is it a disaster waiting to happen?
Oh, this mixed-use development has been a disaster from day one, from the early 2000s. I know of property around Sydney that's been vacant from when they were built in the early 2000s. The commercial side of things have been vacant, and it's an absurd mandate placed on builders and developers. That space would have been better utilised as full residential. There's and it's even worse now. So, with retail, with retail and hospitality was already in trouble before, as I did that video last year, I think early last year when I did that video, and I did a video shot of all the mixed use developments around along the major roads, arterial roads of Sydney, some of the major roads. It was, you know, first of all, you can't stop your car because you get rammed up the arse if you stop to see what's for sale or what's being sold in a particular shop. There's no parking, or if you do find parking is very, very limited. So these retail, you know, outlets, I mean, we're just gonna see them turn, as I said, anything like that is going to be turned more into a ghetto, more into, it's painful to manage, painful to upkeep. The owners can't pay the levies on them on vacant, because it's actually vacant space, and if it's privately owned by they've still got to pay strata levies. Just because it's not rented out doesn't mean that they don't have to pay the strata levies and the upkeep of the common areas. So it's an eyesore. I don't really know what you could do with it, other than try and convert it into residential. But then again, it goes back to the other thought, is there's going to be so many apartments for sale anyway, more residential. It's just a mess. It was never that they look ugly. They'll continue to look ugly, and it's a blotch on our on overall throughout Sydney.
Yeah, and it's of course very important to understand that the economic justification for building the block was to get the rental stream from the retail space, right? So if you're taking that out, then essentially the economics of that whole investment, from whoever made the initial investment, it's not going to work anymore, is it?
No, what I can see happening is that sooner than later, that's going to be very, very cheap commercial real estate if you need an office or storage space. Because there's a lot of it around. There is a lot of it around, and there's a lot more. And again, because of this lockdown and the lockdowns and everything else, and people's how we've changed, with buying more things online, friends and family and relatives are even getting McDonald's delivered a Big Mac meal for $2.50 in some areas. I mean, that's phenomenal. I mean, so why? These things are just going to, I think it's just going to, that real estate is just going to get cheaper and cheaper. So if you do need an office, if you do need space for yourself, it might be a cheap alternative.
Yeah. And, the commercial real estate sector, I've been watching that quite closely, is looking really, really sick. We know there's a lot of supply. We know that rentals are dropping. We know that a number of them are really looking very, very dodgy from a commercial sector. And of course, the banks are exposed to this. So it's interesting that the Reserve Bank minutes last time specifically mentioned commercial real estate as an area of risk. And I think they're absolutely right. Now, here's one from Charlie. Do you think the bank, government, federal, state, can do anything to keep house prices going up, like removing stamp duty, extending 30-year loans to 40 years, or is this a mission impossible? Edwin, what do you think about that?
Look, I think, I don't know, this time around, I think that they're going to try everything. They've already thrown the kitchen sink at it. They've last year they sacrificed the firstborn. So what's next on the agenda, Martin? I don't know. Maybe I really don't. I think it's the I think the turning point's going to be how great of an unemployment figure we're going to end up with. I think that's going to be the leading indicator as to what really happens, because no matter how much you can throw at property, at the property sector by way of grants and by way of extending loans and trying to do this and trying to do that, this beast is already teetering over the cliff with nowhere else to with a steamroller about to hit its ass behind it. I really can't see anything else. And if anything else is thrown at it, is it going to take 6 months? Is it going to take 12 months? More than likely, it'll take 18 months, or even 24 months, 2 years, to get things back on track. Do we have the, do we have the sustainability? Do we have the, does our economic platform have the stamina to last that long? I don't think the construction industry can last the way it's going for more than 6 months. Anything that they try to throw at it, the effect of it is going to take longer than 6 months in order to start taking effect before it really starts picking up momentum. It could be 12 to 18, 24 months. I think we're well and truly. They should just let it go. Let it go and pick up the pieces after it falls, as opposed to trying to kick the can further and further down the field, because there's nowhere else to go other than we got to go over the cliff and find out how many knocks and bruises we can take.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they will do it. They will try absolutely everything. They will go for these 40 or 50,000 K grants. They'll probably allow the banks to reduce their lending standards or extend the loan, all of those sorts of things. But we are at that threshold where those are really not going to have any major effect, in my view. And as Edwin says, it's this unemployment number which is going to be the critical one, and the fact that households are really up against it in terms of their incomes and expenditure and costs, all those things. There is a limiting factor here, and that is people's household's ability to be able to continue to pay ever bigger mortgages, even with low interest rates. And so I think there is a limit, and we're very close to that limit. Now, they'll clearly try. I wouldn't be surprised also if the Reserve Bank starts buying up defaulting property. So it takes them off the bank's balance sheets and they hold on to it and then sort of sell it 20, 30 years later or something like that. Those are the sorts of things they're going to do. All unnatural acts. What they should be doing is recognising that we've had this massive property bubble for at least 20, 30 years, and actually the best long-term thing that could be done is to allow property prices to settle, hopefully not too quickly, but allow them to settle over time, come back to a long-term more sort of mean, and then make property more affordable. Because the fact is, the more you push it out there, the less property is affordable, the more people has to pay to get into it, and the more people then get caught later.
Yeah, and the other thing, Martin, is if you do a quick sum across Sydney, a quick survey across Sydney, right? Pick any property that's listed for sale in a particular suburb anywhere in Sydney. Pick about 10 suburbs, 10 properties, and then look at a like property on the other side of the ledger, on the rental side, and then you determine what the sales price is as to the rental price. Some of the numbers that are coming out from the searches that I do, where you're buying $1.5 million properties and you can rent the bloody things out at $550. Even with such low interest rates, even at 2.5%, you're still better off renting the thing rather than buying it. And then you've got to come up, even if it was only 10% that you had to come up with it in regards to buying it, you still got to come up with $150,000 plus stamp duty. Let's say they waived stamp duty and everything else. You still got to come up with $150,000 as a deposit to buy. And the bank's got to see that you're going to be able to stand on your own 2 feet for a very long time to sustain and pay that loan off. So. I think there are too many properties for lease. The changes aren't happening quick enough. The shift and all these stimulus won't happen quick enough for the construction industry. The migration, if we ever do get to the numbers that we were bringing in prior COVID-19, prior this lockdown, prior this economic downturn, it's going to take years before we get to any form of normality. So I don't think that the market is going to sustain it. In other words, there's not going to be too much of an uptake in rental properties, and it's only now, as you and I have been talking about for months, about the rental market, the mainstream media that have forgot that simple indicator of how the rental yields were diminishing. From over 18 months ago, it was already diminishing. It was already starting to trend down. But nobody wanted to talk about that. Nobody wanted to talk about how that has a long-term effect. in the vacant properties that are available. As I say again, over and over again, it doesn't take a lot more property to come on the for sale side of the ledger, whether it be in Melbourne, Brisbane, or Sydney, in order to bring the property growth or the real estate industry into a coma. We only need a few thousand, and yet there's potentially there's 1.9 million properties out there that are teetering on coming onto the for sale ledger. So if it's only going to take a 1% of that to really cripple the sales market, I mean, I think they're going to too little, too late,
or maybe too much, too early. they've pushed it too far. Now I've got a question here from Siddharth, who says, "How is the Melbourne market looking for the next 18 to 24 months?" Will it take a hit bigger than Sydney because it's heavily dependent on students and tourism? I'll answer that first. The high rental stress, I should say, is in 3,000. And that is simply because there are a lot of people there who suddenly have got no income, whether it was actually students or whether it was people attached to, you know, universities and things. It's a big deal. And my own view is I think that the situation in Melbourne is going to be really, really extreme. And I'm seeing higher levels of stress now in pockets that I wouldn't have expected to see it in, as well as on the urban fringe. I'm now seeing it closer in. So I think you're probably right to say that the Melbourne market is going to look sicker than Sydney. It's grown a little bit faster, actually, earlier on as well. So that's my thought. Anything to add there, Edwin?
Yeah, look, historically, Melbourne has always taken a little bit longer to catch up in order to get the high price grades. And then people, because Sydney becomes unaffordable, people gravitate towards Melbourne. I mean, every cycle, just about every cycle, the same thing happens. And then when the cycle reverts back the other way, Melbourne always ends up falling a lot deeper than what Sydney does, and this time I can't see any different, given the fact that in the Sydney region, on the Domain platform, we've got close to 17,500 properties for sale, and in the Melbourne region, on the Domain platform, we got closer to 30,000 properties for sale. Yeah, almost twice as many as what we have in Sydney. So yes, Melbourne's going to get creamed. It's going to get absolutely smashed because of this. And you only have to look at, you only have to look and see, the amount of people that from Sydney, from other, other major cities that couldn't no longer buy an investment property in Sydney. So they a lot turned their eye and their attention to Melbourne. So. Apart from everything else that you've also mentioned, and the reliance, the heavy reliance on the student dollar as well.
Yeah, no, that's all. I think good points there.
Now, and it gets bloody cold down there.
It gets cold. Yeah. Well, wait 5 minutes, they'll get warm again. Madeline said, Edwin, what are your thoughts on the land sales market in the next 12 months with the current rate of residential construction cancellations?
What are my thoughts on land sales in terms of other than the fact that you could really go and negotiate real strong, good deals? But again, it comes back to what I've been telling quite a lot of my clients that are looking at buying home and land packages. Why buy something new when you can buy something that's perhaps in a bigger block of land and that somebody's put extra bells and whistles to the property for a lot less than what you can buy your house, a brand new specie that's going to cost a lot more than something that's 2 or 3 years old. I think this is the time to buy somebody else's unfortunately somebody else's demise or somebody else's pain. Take advantage of that because there's going to be a lot more of that available. Then if I was looking at land, I'd be looking at older homes in established areas with bigger blocks of land for if you want to do a bit of land banking. That's what I'd be looking for, as opposed to going out into the subdivisions. There are so many more subdivisions that haven't been brought onto the market for various reasons. So a lot of the general population don't really understand, don't really get how much land really is available out there to subdivide. So I tend to look more for established areas on bigger blocks with very older homes if you're going to look at doing a bit of land banking. So that's my from both sides of the spectrum, with the new subdivision and with the old. Because the new subdivision, well, there's something around the corner that was built a year ago or 2 years ago, and there's going to be a lot of pain there. For all this, we haven't seen. I guess we spoke about something along these lines, Martin, about 18 months ago when we were talking about the new subdivisions and the pains, and then you've got the young families that end up splitting up and what the economic woes that families end up going through, and there's going to be a lot of that, and unfortunately there's going to be a lot of separations. And there's going to be that type of property that's going to come on the market. So I don't think, unless you're getting it at 50% off what the landowner's getting, I personally wouldn't chase it.
Yeah, and of course land values have dropped in the particularly out as you go further out. You know, the asking price is in some cases half from where it was. So that gives you a bit of an indication of supply, demand, price, I was listening to someone the other day arguing that, of course, property around Badger's Creek will go through the roof because, of course, the airport will, maybe eventually, but I think there's a long way to go yet. Now, Stefan's asked this question. My cousin is selling at $1.45 million. It's a duplex, 20 minutes near Parramatta. How are agents allowed to provide an illusionary value to get sellers? So this is a question of, what's the story they tell, Edwin, to try and get people through the door, even if the price looks a bit excessive?
So his cousin is selling a duplex for $1.4
million.
Yep.
Somewhere around Parramatta.
Yep.
And how does the agent create a story to bring buyers in? I guess you contact the creators of the hedonic never to be seen again daily index, and maybe they can flog it off to their clients, or get somebody that's involved with Spruconomics, and get them. Look, there is no there is no illusion. A lot of agents, what they would do, I guess, is at 1.4 around Parramatta, I'm just trying to think where it would be. It would probably be around Dundas, Cullingford, around those areas for a duplex. Could even be around I'm just trying to think. It's got to have something out of the normal in order to attract people, especially as more properties come on the market. Unless you saw the property, unless you had a little bit more detail, I couldn't really give them much more than just a general idea. It's going to get harder and harder to sell property anywhere, and you've got to have that point of difference. If it's tenanted, bend over backwards to assist the tenant to maintain the property, because obviously first impressions count. If it's owner-occupied, well, make sure that everything's spick and span as well, in order to get the right shots and the right video footage and everything else in order to put it on the market. There's your market. It's the way it's presented. There's no more smoke and mirrors as such with regard to the presentation. And other than that, it's really what are the facilities, the attributes of the property.
Yeah, but interesting. I've never quite understood this, Edwin. If you've got a high rise, you know, you're one in a thousand in an apartment, and there are lots of similar properties, you know, in the same area, I don't see how you can differentiate your particular unit in that high rise from the one over there, from the one over there. I mean, it's a commodity, isn't it?
Yeah, look, Mark, again, it goes back to the presentation. I've sold apartments in the same complex, same floor plan, same side of the building. So just, you know, same for same. And I've been able to achieve higher for my vendor, but because we were able to work with a tenant. The agents have got to be able to work with a tenant. There are a lot of good agents out there that will accommodate the tenants. But as a vendor, if you're going to be selling, and you're going to be selling, you know, like, you know, one of these Lego boxes, you know, that's just, you know, so much floor space and it's got the same view as your competitor and everything else. Well, it goes back to the agent's got to make themselves more available than the other agent. They've got to be willing to extend the viewing times. They've got to put in the work and they've got to put in the effort. There's a little bit more effort that's going to be asked of the agent in order for you to be to have the lead in that particular, you know, sales race, because it is a race. And if, as I said, you've got to be prepared, meet the market. Don't hold on to illusionary figures. You know, if you know, be quick, and meet the market, as opposed to just do your own research. As I keep on saying, do your own research. If you're not happy with what one agent's selling, you know, interview a few agents in order to make up your mind as to who you're going to go with. Don't just throw your money and park your money with the agent that's managing the property.
Yeah, thanks, Edwin, for that. Well, we're nearly coming up to the hour, so I don't know how much more of this you can take, Edwin. I've got loads more questions, but
we can go until the cows come home.
Okay. Yeah. Now, one of the interesting questions that somebody's asked is, what is the typical investment ratio of investment property now at the moment? And I guess that goes to a broader question about what are the returns from investment property, because if you think about it, most investment properties are relying on capital growth. Well, assuming there's no capital growth from this point, in fact, the opposite, then you can look at cash flow, which is rental in versus what you're paying out. And 60% of property investors in my modelling lose money day in, day out, week in, week out at the moment. So do you think the investment property philosophy and the expectation is just completely off the wall now, or what?
Well, a lot of books are going to have to be rewritten, aren't they? And you've got to have a job to in order to negative gear as well. And so with no job, no negative gearing as it is, but you still got to make the repayments, with after tax dollars and so forth. Look, I think it really is going to be interesting. It's uncharted waters to an extent. And this is my fear, is that the Chinese investors that started buying into these developments, particularly the apartments and other strata lots, that if they decide to start selling, once again, we don't have, because they want to save their principal places of residence or their businesses or their lifestyle back in China. If they start offloading those properties, we're in a world of, kaka. It's going to be unprecedented. So there are so many grenades that could be thrown at this market. And in terms of, I think the ones that, The properties that I see that are going to weather the storm a lot better are going to be the smaller set strata blocks, the old three-story walk-ups, anything without lifts, you might say, to better explain to your viewers. It's going to be hard. Until we start bringing in numbers by way of students closer to the universities, and by way of migrants and workers, unless those numbers really start to climb, and I'm talking about hundreds and hundreds of thousands, well, really, there's not going to be there's going to be a lot of vacancy around, isn't it? And investors are just going to they've got to decide to either hold on, try to wear it out, or simply like Lindsay David's proposal, it'll be cheaper for the it'll be cheaper for everybody in general just to hand the keys back to the bank, and it'll be a lot easier, and then for governments to take over these assets and then put them back into affordable housing type of scenario rather than go through the whole process of bankruptcies and liquidation and mortgagee and receiverships and the like. Another interesting fact, Martin, is that as you know, it'd be interesting to see how many mortgages that are on that interest holiday. How many of them are also attached to businesses? Because although we talk about mortgages, something like 439,000 mortgages that are on hold or on a holiday, but we don't know how many properties that represents. Not only do we not know, or we've got an idea, it's about 700,000 properties that represents, but how many of those mortgages are also attached with to business with business loans and the like. So I think there's a lot more pain to be played out before anything can be rewritten.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think Edward. Now here's one, which is a bit long, but it's very interesting. I own a 1950s house on the block in Liverpool, quite close to the CBD. It's an investment property, and the current tenants have given notice. I got an assessment recently, and the value was dropped to the point where my mortgage is higher than the current value. So what do you think I should do? Is it possible? Should I try and pay my mortgage down faster? Should I try to sell it? Should I try to relet it? I bought in 2017. The value is around 20% lower than what I paid for it. Boy, I'm getting quite a few of those stories, Edwin.
Yeah, well, again, let's prefix a lot of this, and we should have said it at the beginning. This obviously isn't financial advice that we're providing. I think we need to understand and learn a little bit more as to what's actually, what the circumstances are before we could go ahead and give any recommendation. The only recommendation that I could give as a licensed real estate agent is to take charge after the particular person has discussed the financial situation with their accountant and with financial planner or whoever else they need to seek that advice from. All I can do is try to, anybody in the industry can do, is really try to get the best price that we can if we do take carriage of the sale. I think it's a hard one to answer without a lot more detail, and I quite frankly don't really want to theoretically I would say I think it's going to become a lot more painful, particularly in those areas again, and particularly when you can. If they've noticed a 20% drop, I think that's just the beginning in a lot of areas, especially older homes that need a lot of maintenance and a lot of. If it was built in the 50s, it'll be just full of asbestos. It'll be full of all sorts of issues, and maintenance is just going to get more and more expensive. So without understanding, without knowing the full ins and outs, happy to give them some free advice if they DM me on through my Twitter account, Martin. I'd need to be able to assist them a little bit more, but on air, that's as much as I could say, I think.
No, fair enough. And the reason I put that question out to you, Edwin, was not because I think there's a definitive answer, because there isn't, right? But
no.
It shows you how complex the calculation is, right? With prices falling, with a rental stream disappearing, with, as you say, probably construction issues and asbestos and all those things in older properties. This is extremely complicated, and that's why many people are really trying to wrestle with what to do. Now, in my surveys, a month ago, there were 8% of property investors saying that they would consider selling in the next year. That's gone up to 12% in a month. And so I think this is an indication of some of the difficulties that people are now facing, where effectively all of the maths of property investing have just gone to pieces. And I'm afraid that there's no simple answer, you know. And I think I said it earlier on, I'll say it again, if you bought a dog, then it's still a dog. whatever you do, it's still a dog.
Yeah, well, that's it. It's, it really is hard, mate. It really, really is hard. I mean, it's a question of how, you know, if you got your hand stuck in a mincer, sooner or later you got to pull it out. How much pain you can bear is up to the individual. But if you're in there, you want to just lose your fingers, well, so be it. But if you want to go all the way, thinking the pain's going to go away, the indicators for me are not there for a lot of this investment pain to go away anytime soon. As I said, as far as I'm concerned, I don't see anything that's indicative of to bring about a major positive change. Both from looking at the overseas, so-called overseas investors' appetite and what's happening internationally, locally, with regard to unemployment, the pain that the retail, the pain that my industry is going through as well. And there's, you know, as I said, there's 53,000 real estate agents in New South Wales, and how many of them have got mortgages that are still yet to be paid off and the like. So there's a lot of pain yet to come. So the indicators aren't there for relief. Of any thought, in my view, I think the pain's only going to get stronger. There's a lot more to play out before it starts to get better. I think.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a comment there from Cookie Boy who said maybe the whole block of Opal Tower is going up for sale. I don't know whether that's true or not, but that's an interesting.
That's Mascot Tower, but. I guess Cookie Boy and a few others that we've discussed Opal Tower and Mascot Tower and that I think all I can say is to all the people that we've had discussed all these things in the past, I think we're a lot closer to having that picnic and bringing the tequila and the popcorn and watching them demolish, and I think Mascot Tower could be first.
Demolish itself if they're not careful. Now, here's one from Mark. How do you think the likes of Westfield, Stockland and AMP will fare when a lot of retailers just won't be returning to fill the space?
Sporty on Twitter alluded to a lot of some of the pain that Westfields were already going through, and this is before the bushfires, before coronavirus, before COVID-19, before the bushfires early last year. We were already noticing, and I was posting out and tweeting out, and Cookie Boy was also posting out some of the vacancies around the major shopping centres and the car parks. Pretty much empty because retail was already going through a lot of pain, and last year was a year for a lot of franchise retailers to hang up their boots as well. So when anchor tenants start falling by the wayside, well, it's the anchor tenants that make it possible for the other small retailers in coffee shops and those bling shops and $2 shops to basically have some sort of business as well. So when you got your major franchise groups that are going bust, well, obviously it's a no-brainer that everybody else is going to go there. Now, at that time, Sporty had put out some information, the fact that back in early 2019, 30% or 35% of the shop owners in Westfields were something like 60 to 90 days in arrears with the rent. So one can only imagine what's going to happen moving forward. And again, before I went to China, and I went to China in December, before I went to China and I was going to Parramatta Westfields, I was noticing that before the coronavirus, before COVID-19 even was known, I noticed in the Parramatta Westfield alone, there were four or five shops that were boarded up, something I've never seen before. We can only guess and try to guesstimate what's gonna happen moving forward, and how much tolerance or how much leeway are they going to give retailers in order to see if they can trade out? But the big question is, Martin, can a lot of these businesses trade out of the demise that they're in? I don't think 50% are definitely. In my books, 50% are well and truly in the red, and they'll never be able to trade out of the demise at the moment.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I remember, of course, that a lot of these big companies actually have a lot of superannuation money invested. So in a way, this is another backdoor degrading of superannuation performance that people haven't got their head around. That's why I said commercial property and the issues around commercial property to me are probably some of those critical issues to watch. Because if you look in what happened in the US and if you look in the UK, it was the commercial property sector that went first. And the residential took quite a lot longer to sort of work through. Now, Ross asked a really interesting question. You just said they will try their best to keep house prices high. Why can you play devil's advocate? In other words, why is it that they want to keep prices high? Okay, well, I'll give you my three reasons. Edwin may have other ones as well. Anyway, first one is the wealth effect. So if property prices are high, you feel more wealthy, you're going to spend more, and half of the GDP in Australia is driven directly from retail spending. So that's the first point. Second point is the banks have huge exposure to the property sector. They've got more than 60% of their business into mortgages, plus the commercial as well. And so if property prices degrade, suddenly those investments and those mortgages look dodgy. They have to put more capital against them. That puts pressure on the banks, and it puts pressure on the banking system. And thirdly, the stamp duty that's created through transactions supports most of the states, particularly New South Wales, $8 billion each year in terms of revenue from stamp duty. If that goes away, they've got big issues with regard to managing the commercial parameters of the state finances. And then the final point is, it's actually driving construction, because essentially construction is about 1 million or more employed in construction, drives the GDP directly. And if you can build more stuff, then you can actually lift the GDP number, despite the fact that we've got more than 1 million spare properties in Australia at the moment and another 250 being built at the moment. So those are some of the reasons why governments want to do it. The myth is that there's an undersupply. The myth is that it's actually all being created by migration or foreign buyers. The myth is it's all to do with property investors. No, the myth is that we've got this massive bubble driven by massive amounts of debt, and we've got the highest ratios around, either first or second, depending on which one you look at. And it's because we've allowed this to grow over 20 to 30 years, and that's why we've now got to the extent I think that we can get to before things change. But those are the reasons why the government will try and keep things bubbling along. Anything to add, Edwin?
No, other than everybody took a, not everybody, but a lot of people took a drink of that Kool-Aid, and that was that the hedonic never to be seen again index had spiked with whatever it spiked with, and everybody wanted to be a property star, a property guru. And have four or five and retire before their 50 with a portfolio of 10, 15, 20 properties. And unfortunately, as you pointed out, the banks and the government made it easy for a lot of I think they made it easy and they became complicit in allowing fraudulent loans and fraudulent activity, and more so from overseas, but we won't go into that too much. And because they were, yeah, the fix of the stamp duty was such that they couldn't, they couldn't get away from it. It's a drug that the state government and the state governments couldn't let go of. They got hooked on it. Hence the reason why they laxed the regulations from the Foreign Investment Review in terms of in the early 2000s. We could only sell 22% of an apartment complex to foreign investors. And then when they laxed the regulations in 2014, 2015, and then all of a sudden, about 2012, I think it was, when they laxed the regulations and then all of a sudden you could sell the whole apartment complex to foreign investors. It was just phenomenal. I mean, it was just a drug that the state governments couldn't let go of.
Yeah, no, I agree with that, Edwin. And it's a drug that everyone's been on for a long time. And unfortunately, when any withdrawal process, it's painful. Now, just a few of the people who actually made contributions. Ron, thank you very much for your contribution. Nico, yours too. Geston as well. El Porno, I've already acknowledged that. John said, what is the chance that they can change the negative gearing rates, bring negative gearing for 5 years for your family home, for example? I'll give you an answer on that. It's certainly, I think, one of the things I would not be surprised to see. So in the UK, there was at some stage in the process tax breaks on owner-occupied property. So you actually got money from the government if you bought an owner-occupied property. That could well be on their agenda. It's nuts if they do it, but they certainly might. And Major Mayhem asked, what do you think about property price falling further south of Campbelltown? Will the price drop harder than in Sydney? Edwin, what do you think about Campbelltown?
Campbelltown is an interesting area. They try to rebuild the CBD. Unfortunately, I think with the push Department of Housing, push away from to build more. More affordable housing down towards Campbelltown. It's a big area. There's a lot of room around there, Minto and the like. So there are a lot of subdivisions that obviously haven't been built yet. There's a lot of land. There's a lot of vacant land there. There's a lot of potential. But I think it's just the demographics, the general demographics there. There's a lot of lot of change. It is interesting. I think it's going to fall a lot more. I think it generally falls a little bit more than what the Blacktown region does. For various reasons. But then again, there are also some very affluent parts of Campbelltown, where you've got some big properties on decent, on 800 square meter blocks. And the like. So it depends what part. If you're talking about the older, you've got a lot of the older housing commission areas that are actually very close to which around Sturt Street and those streets there, the older housing commission areas there. There's some nice blocks there, and yet you're only a stone's throw away from the CBD. So it's a very, very interesting mix. Again, similar to Blacktown as well, because even Blacktown has the older homes closer to the CBD, and then you not too far away, you've got the newer subdivisions that are, you could almost pay twice as much for a property there, and you sort of wonder why. But look, it's a mix. Sydney itself, that's what we say. There are many markets in Sydney. It's not just one market.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And, the point I always say is you've got to look local, you've got to get local information. It's hard to make general statements. A couple of other things. Gersten, you were saying you're 36-year-old, 200K, I assume that's your savings, got cash flow, found a property, should you buy or wait? Tough question to know without knowing more about. But generally, if you can assume that prices will fall from this point, as they probably will, and you can lose some of that equity and you're okay with that, and you intend to hold the property for a long period of time, it may be worth doing. But otherwise, probably best to wait and just see how things settle. There will be plenty of time to buy property, and you can probably buy better later next year for cheaper. And Ross, thank you very much for your contribution. Very grateful for that. Now, I see Edwin's got his hat back on. Is that a signal that you're getting tired, Edwin?
No, we can keep on going. If you like, mate, I just put it on because, you know, it's getting a little bit cool and my head's getting a little bit cold. But other than that, also to just remind the general public that, you know, I'm looking for a president, a treasurer. I've got to put this cabinet together in order to, for Blacktown to secede from the Commonwealth.
Yes, exactly. Put something up at the borders and control it all. Okay, now people have been asking quite a few questions about individual suburbs and, you know, individual geographies. So, for example, Brisbane. I'll suggest that Brisbane houses probably won't do too bad because they haven't really bubbled up. But units, I think I'm very concerned about. My view is that units in the Brisbane area, particularly closer to the CBD, are overpriced, and we're already seeing some signs of slippage. Further out into the suburbs, again, some houses, older houses on larger blocks won't do too bad, but some of the small, modern, recently constructed stuff looks to me to be quite dodgy at the minute. So that's the Brisbane question.
Well, we might have a bit of an issue there with Brisbane, with Queensland in general. If the Premier and Pauline Hanson end up in the High Court, so there's a bit of issue there with what's happening, how that's going to affect the local economy, and I guess, you know, they're very heavily reliant on tourism. Everything's playing in there. You can't just look at a market or a particular suburb and look at what's happening in that suburb. You literally got to look at everything globally, because whatever's happening globally could literally affect what's happening in Blacktown, Campbelltown, Minto, North Sydney, Epping, Chatswood, Eastwood, whatever. We're so far away from the rest of the world, but yet the rest of the world is we have it so close at hand that it affects whatever's happening in overseas does have an effect in local markets. And this thing that's playing out at the moment with regard to the closure of the borders and the economic strife that they're going to continue to go through if the borders aren't opened up, I mean, that's going to have a huge effect for future sentiment for people to invest in Queensland, isn't it?
Yeah, you're right about that. And, it's hard to know exactly how this is all going to play out, but you can assume low migration. You can assume that there will be people moving from high expense areas to lower expense areas. There's still some drift up to Queensland relative to other states, because prices in some areas are quite a lot lower. But then, of course, you've also got the mining areas of Queensland where they've also got a lot of issues. And I look at Ipswich and places like that, which again have massive mortgage stress and default risk issues. So it's a pretty tricky across the board. Now, there's a whole bunch of questions which we're probably not going to get through tonight, but there's a couple. There was one said, look, when there's a listing price, how much wriggle room is there in terms of negotiation? And now, I don't know what the average is, but it used to be about 7-8% in and around Sydney. Has it got bigger? In other words, do people tend to ask one price and end up settling lower?
It just depends how much of a bastard you want to be, doesn't it? And you want to go in there, you want to... back in the day, it used to be there's 5%. 5 to 10% that it's been put on top of what the owner's going to be really wanting. At the end of that, once you've done your research, and if you're noticing that there's a lot more listings coming onto the market, you've got a lot better chance of asking for a greater discount than your 5% or 10% or 15%. You just got to be Some people are too afraid to put in a lowball offers. We often see these articles of the brokers and certain agents and certain mainstream property writers talk about how dare buyers come in and put lowball offers wanting to get a cheap price. Well, that's the game. If you don't want to, if you don't think it's fair, then play the game. That is the game. I mean, you know, that's why they've hired a so-called professional real estate agent to sell the property in order to achieve a higher price. And you've got to deal with people that are going to put local offers. You still get people still putting lowball offers when the market is going up. So more of a reason to put even a lower ball offer when the market's going down, especially when you can see, when you've got certain indicators in your area or the particular type of property that you're after. When you see more and more listings of similar property in the area that you're looking for, in the ideal that property that you're wanting to buy as an investment, as an owner occupier. Well, guess what? It's economies of scale. If there's a lot more to choose from, I'm sure you're going to get a vendor that's going to be more willing. And the other thing is, get the reports. There are some, do a little bit more research, and you try and find out. This is what I do, obviously, for my clients, is try and find out what is the underlying motivation of the vendor, and not only that, and obviously I'll get the certain questions that I ask the selling agents, but also I'll also do a bit of research and find out who owns it, when they bought it, how much they bought it for, because that also allows me to see how much of a low ball offer they're willing to accept before I get told to piss off. I mean, I often get told to piss off, but that's the game, isn't it? And if you can't wear it, well, don't play.
Yeah, well, I've always said to people, you can put a low price in and go up, but if you go in and offer a high price, you can't come down. So, the psychology has to be you go in low and climb up, surely.
Yeah, and there are some interesting properties that I'm looking for some clients presently, and where I've noticed that there's certain properties have been transferred. Obviously, it's as some people have inherited the property 2-3 years ago, so there's obviously they're going to be a lot more motivated to accept an offer, especially if it's a signed contract and if it's something that's solid and it's no bank loan necessary, and wants somebody to move, they're going to be more willing to accept 20% below what the agent may be seeking to achieve, because at the end of the day they inherited or they bought it 20 years ago, 25 years ago for 500, it's on the market for 1.2 now. They'll be happy to accept 900 if it's a quick sell, because there's still a bit of beef in there and it's been an investment property for the last 25, 30 years. So they're the motor, that's what you got to determine, is to determine what type of offer you put in there. But that's the stuff that we do with the tools that we have available, and there are some free tools out there as well. And you can pay for certain reports, you just have to know how to get them and where to get them.
Yeah, no, thanks, Edwin, for that. Now, a very interesting one from Vincent. Edwin, the hedonic index, the hedonic never to be seen again index, let's get that right. If it ever gets resurrected, do you think it's a good leading indicator to buy again?
No, it's, look, let's get it right. That meteorite that bought in COVID-19 that I thought took out the hedonic daily index, never to be seen again. It actually didn't take it out. I was wrong. It was the double that it took out. It's still there. It's still working away in the background. So we took a body double out. It's in hiding. It's in a bunker somewhere. It'll pop out. Interestingly, we're going to see whether or not it pops out next week, Martin, because this week in the Sydney region, I saw that there's something like 365 properties that are going to be taken to auction on the weekend. It's almost double what it has been, just over more than double what we've had in previous weeks. So surely that's got to be relevant now to the hedonic I'm hiding in a bunker somewhere index, to be able to get some so-called daily indices up, so we can see what's going on. But as an indicator, if you look at some of the the reports that it brings out, and you compare what it says a property is going to sell for and what it actually sells for, in some cases a miles apart. There is another company that's bringing out a more live data type. I can't remember the name of it. If people follow me on Twitter, I'll put it out tomorrow. I'll remind everyone tomorrow. But it's and you can get more live data in comparison to what's actually happening, which is, I think it's more real, but it's a lot closer to the truth. Giving in mind that the hedonic has always been 60 to 72 days behind. They say it's the worst case scenario, but I say it's the best case scenario, because I've been following them since 2007, and also been in the industry for a lot longer. So I know the delays in the data as a real estate agent, and as in order to understand values of properties when we give people information as to what's happening in the areas or in the suburbs.
Yeah, thanks, Edwin, on that. And yeah, my take on the indices is that you've got to be very careful with them. They're very generic, they're very average anyway. So to my mind, they don't tell you a hell of a lot. Major Mayhem asked, what is your formula and factors to look at when guessing how badly potential price drops are in a certain area? Well, I do it in my modelling. I model it down to a postcode level. I look at supply demand. I look at the economic parameters, number of people. In my surveys, I have a view as to what people are looking to buy or looking to sell. I put that in, and I basically use that to manipulate the baseline numbers. So I do it at a postcode level based on my surveys. I'm sure other people will do it different ways. Also, another question about Hobart and mortgage stress. Basically saying, what's your take on Hobart and mortgage stress there, given the reduction in tourism? Yeah, well, I'm certainly seeing significant rises in stress in Hobart. The proportion of households in stress is some of the highest in the country now, unfortunately, because of that. And I wouldn't be surprised to see some significant slides in prices in Hobart, because I think the parameters there have changed. Depends a bit on what the local councils and what have you do there as well. They might well try and support it, but I'm not sure they'll be able to do that. Just going down the list, what's your thoughts about withdrawing from your super during COVID-19 to use as a deposit to buy a home? My answer there is, well, you're going to be drawing money out when superannuation is already going down. If you then take that money out at a lower level and then put it to buy a property, and property is also going to go down, you could lose twice. So I would be very, very cautious and careful about it. I know some people are using those 10Ks, this either side of 30th of June to build a deposit and then try and get the government scheme to support it. But remember, if you go into a property with 5% equity and property prices move 5%, you end up with zero, because you lose first. So I would be a little bit cautious on that. And then just going down the page. I think we've pretty much covered it. No, I think Cookie Boy made a tweet earlier on that we got above our target. So if we did, then tremendous. In terms of thanks very much for spending some time with us tonight. Edwin, any last thoughts from you? I've got one last question I'd like your views on. This is from Jill. I'm preparing my property for market. It's a house in the inner suburbs. What are the top 5 things I should do to maximise its potential? Should I repaint, clean the outside, redo the garden? Does it make any difference?
It makes a big difference. I've always said for many years, I put out some videos as well, and how far a little bit of elbow grease will go in order to present a property. First impressions count, and first impressions don't necessarily happen when people come to the front door and come and visit the home. The first impressions that count are also what's posted online, in the format and the type of photos, the photography, the videography. They are the first impressions that people see, is what people see online, and then obviously it'll be a closer representation of what they see live. So when they approach, as they approach the property, I'm surprised why a lot more people don't necessarily for example, wash down the tile roofs that are all, black and mossy and whatnot. It only costs $600-$700 to wash it down, but yet it makes a huge impression. When you're photographing the property for sale, gardens particularly. I've seen some atrocious things. You don't have to go online to see what people post online, although the sales side of things have gotten better over the years. But if you go to the rental section, given the fact that there's such a lot of pressure on investors and on property owners, and yet some of the photos that you see that are posted online to sort of entice renters to come and rent properties are absolutely laughable. So a lick of paint. Not everybody likes your yellow room. Not everybody likes your purple lounge room or blue dining room and green master bedroom. A lick of paint, a coat of paint to give it a neutral colour for the next person, then to decorate it the way they want, makes a big impression as well. But this is the big thing, Martin. You always assess what you're willing to spend to determine how much you're going to get in return at the end. Obviously, I always say to people to don't go renovating full on renovating, because your type of renovation won't necessarily mean it's the next person taste and choice as well, but rather just clean it up, tidy it up, spruce it up in order to maximize the sale. But again, if they're in Sydney, free to being one of your followers, Martin, I'm free to give them a little bit more advice as to what they can do and not overspend to achieve the same result.
Yeah, well, thanks, Edwin. I wouldn't be surprised if your inbox on Twitter gets inundated. When I mentioned last week about mortgage stress data at a postcode level, I had thousands and thousands of people asking me for the information. I got through most of them now. And just for those people who asked tonight, we're not going to look at mortgage stress this week, but next week, same time, same station, we are going to spend some more time on mortgage stress. So if you've got postcodes that you'd like me to share information about, I can do it next week. It'll be at 8 p.m. Tuesday as normal. Edwin, we've had such a fun time tonight. I hope you have. I certainly have. That if you're up for it, I wouldn't mind doing this again sometime, because I've lots of questions we didn't get to tonight. I've got loads here from earlier on that we haven't got to. There's lots of people really love your detailed understanding of what's going in the property sector, something which is very rare, and you know, I think people really value it. So I want to say thank you for your time tonight, Edwin. And any last thoughts before we go off air?
Just thank you, and look, I want to thank all your followers as well. I can really sense the acceptance of what the conversations and the videos that we put together are by the comments that they leave behind, and obviously the more they support the channel, the more they support you, and the more information we can get out there, the more knowledge that people have, the better educated decisions that they can make. Again, I'll say I'm happy to answer questions. I've helped a few of the people that with some of the residential tenancy issues that they've had when you posted out that my Twitter handle before, and happy to do so. Some people have offered to buy me this or buy me that or send me this or send me that, but it's just for the love of the industry, love of the work that we do, in wanting to get the information out there. Look, I certainly felt the warmth from doing the show, and enjoyed talking to you as all as we do, Martin, off camera and on camera. Really enjoyed.
Great. Well, thanks, Edwin. Well, we got 1,300 Max views tonight, so I think that's amazing. So thank you very much for everybody who's been on. Apologies for the audio. Next time we'll fix that up. As I said, I had a major technical issue just before I came on air tonight, so we've struggled through with slightly kludged, but anyway, I hope Ian was audible. I want to thank you, Edwin, for your insights and your time tonight. You know, you are worth your weight in gold. And, you know, I haven't got any gold to give you, but we'll hopefully, you know, be able to have another conversation through. I've already got people on the chat saying, yes, yes, please, more Edwin. So, yeah, we'll bring Edwin back. I promise you, we'll bring Edwin back. And don't forget, next week we'll be doing more on mortgage stress as well as my normal update with regard to the latest news. Please like, please subscribe, please spread the word. What we're trying to do here is to provide you with information so that you can make better decisions about your financial future. We're not flogging anything. We're not flogging technical solutions or anything like that. We're trying to provide you with information which actually is probably worth its weight in gold too, if you did but know it. So I want to say thank you all very much. Edwin, any last thought from you?
No, mate. Just stay safe, stay healthy, and wear a mask.
Yeah. Good advice, Edwin. Thank you very much. Take care, everybody. And this is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics signing off with a caveat. This was not financial advice. We don't give financial advice on this channel. We're talking generally about situations based on our knowledge and experience, but please don't take it as financial advice. Thanks, Edwin. See you next time.
Cheers, mate.
See everybody. Bye bye. Martin North signing off.